The big thing is the application of the lesson. Will you apply what you are learning? Or once this seminar is over, you feel great. Yeah, rah, rah, great talk. I'm motivated. And then the next day you go back to your old habits.
Welcome to the Building Excellence Podcast. I'm your host, Bailey Miles. The Building Excellence Podcast is all about sharing inspiring stories from some of the most successful athletes, coaches, business minds, and thought leaders to help you build excellence in your life, leadership, and legacy. To learn more, visit baileymiles.com and be sure to rate, review, and follow us on all social media platforms. Now let's get to the show and start building excellence in your life, leadership, and legacy. Matt Doherty is the former University of North Carolina head men's basketball coach, player, and national champion. He was also the head coach at Notre Dame, SMU, and Florida Atlantic. Matt grew up in New York with a close family and parents who led by example. His hard work and discipline enabled him to earn a scholarship to play at UNC. Matt was a starter on the 1982 UNC National Championship team, coached by Hall of Famer Dean Smith. At Carolina, Matt played alongside Michael Jordan, James Worthy, Sam Perkins, Brad Doherty, and many others. He was drafted in the 1984 NBA Draft. After playing, he stepped into Wall Street before deciding to get back into coaching. He is now an executive coach and gives keynote speeches. He is also the author of the best-selling book Rebound, From Pain to Passion, Leadership Lessons Learned. On the show, he tells his story of playing, coaching, being coached, getting bitter or getting better, developing emotional intelligence, applying what you learn, building a personal board of directors, note-taking, leadership, parenting, and much more. For more info on Matt and his coaching or book, check out DohertyCoaching.com. Enjoy the show. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Building Excellence Podcast. Today, I have a special guest, Coach Matt Doherty, with me. Coach, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Bailey.
Yeah. Well, if you wouldn't mind, maybe give our listeners some context to your life and growing up and what life was like for you.
Oh, gosh. I grew up in New York. I grew up in Long Island. My dad was owned a Pepsi route. He was from Brooklyn. My mom was from the Bronx, one of five kids, Irish Catholic, loved sports, had great teams to root for, from the Knicks to the Nets to the Rangers to the Islanders to the Giants to the Jets to the Yankees to the Mets. And, you know, I played all sports, all seasons. And then in sixth grade, I focused just on basketball and was consumed with the sport. Was blessed to play for great high school coaches. Bob McKillop, who ended up coaching Steph Curry at Davidson, was my high school coach for 2 years. And then I had a Dick Zeitler. We won a state championship. Then I went to North Carolina, played for a legendary coach, Dean Smith. Won a national championship in 82 with a guy named Michael Jordan, James Worthy, Sam Perkins. I played with Kenny Smith, Brad Doherty. I was blessed to play with great players and great coaches. Roy Williams, Eddie Fogler, and Bill Guthridge were the assistant coaches on that staff. And then I got cut by the NBA and was really hurt by it. I felt like I loved basketball and it didn't love me back. So I went to work on Wall Street because I thought that would be a cool substitute. And after 4 years, I realized I didn't like it. So I quit and looked to get into the real estate business in Charlotte. And I was really chasing the money, probably, you know, and the fame that goes with it. And then I started coaching an AAU team and loved it. And I was doing the radio at Davidson at the time, and they made a coaching change and they hired Bob McKillop. So Bob hired me as an assistant. And then I went on my coaching journey. I was there for 3 years, Kansas for seven under Roy Williams. And again, you go back to, these are gentlemen I played for. So the relationships are so important. Mm-hmm. And then I became the head coach. My first head coaching job was at Notre Dame. And, you know, an Irish Catholic kid from Long Island being the head coach at Notre Dame was kind of cool, to say the least. And then I thought I'd be there for a long time. And then Bill Guthridge resigned at North Carolina. Roy Williams was slated to get the job. He turned it down and they came to me and I accepted the job. We were number one in the country. My first year was National Coach of the Year. 2 years later, there was political unrest. They questioned my leadership and they asked me to resign. So you go from the penthouse to the outhouse pretty quick. And it took me on a leadership journey, Bailey, that really, you know, I always say you get bitter or get better. And I decided to get better and went on this leadership journey and realized that leadership is a learned behavior. Realized that leadership is the most important topic that's not formally taught. And even if it was formally taught, it still needs to be practiced. It's like golf. Like if you're not practicing, you're going to hit the ball all over the golf course and not play well. Yeah. Leadership is like that. It needs to be practiced. You need to go to the range with your swing coach, watch film, tweak your swing, and you'll never perfect it. You'll get better, but you'll never perfect it. But you need to practice it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, there's a lot in your story right there. But even going back to the early years, you talk about your leadership journey. How important were your parents leading you growing up? And what are some of the values that they instilled in you? Because I know you touch on core values as well. What were those things that they instilled in you at a young age that really helped you, you know, succeed as you went on in your career?
Yeah, I think, you know, just the simple things, really. It's fundamentals, right? Be on time. Listen, work hard, you know, play nice with others. You know, it wasn't anything magical. And I just think, you know, I saw my dad get up every day at like 5:30 to go to work, you know, and in the snow and the rain, you know, he never complained. They really reinforced being humble. And then I remember I was telling a story the other day. I was in fourth grade. My dad signed me up for basketball camp, bought me my first jock. And we're in the car and he's, you know, handing me the jock. And he said, you know, when a coach tells you, when a coach corrects you, don't say, I know, just listen. And I thought back to that day when I was coaching my son in the driveway, throwing a football. I was trying to teach him how to catch the ball. And he kind of came back at me like, I know, Dad, I know. And I'm like, oh my God, now I know why my dad said that to me, because I was just like my son. And, you know, because no one likes to coach a know-it-all, right? So you want to be coachable. And my dad was a minor league baseball player and a very good high school athlete. So he knew. But sometimes you don't take the lessons from your parents as much as you do the lessons from the people in your community, like your coaches and your teachers. So I think that looking back, I wish I listened to my parents probably more, but they put us in position to learn from a community at St. Raphael's Grammar School and Holy Trinity High School, where I was surrounded with very good teachers and coaches. And had very good coaches growing up. Eighth grade, Mr. Coleman, Bob McKillop, Dick Zeitler, you know, guys that would push you, discipline you, and teach you the fundamentals. And I think that I was blessed at a very early age to be surrounded by great coaches. And then the coaches at the camps that I went to. I was blessed to have grow up where I grew up when I grew up.
Yes, and I think you touched on a really good point of having a community around you to learn from. Coaches, families, obviously your parents as well. And I'm sure your siblings too. I'm sure you learned some stuff from your siblings at times. Yeah. Maybe not the moment.
The three older sisters, and you know, they love me. And then I had a brother, and have a brother, and you know, just, you know, team. You know, it's a team. You know, you got your chores, you got to do the dishes, you got to, everything's a negotiation, right? Like, I'm in next to the bathroom. We had seven people six people trying to share one bathroom upstairs.
Yeah.
My mom's used the bathroom downstairs. I mean, I look back on that house and it was very small for a family of seven. But we made it work. And yeah, everything's a negotiation, right? You're like, I'm in next. Someone's calling next to go into the shower and you slide in before them and lock the door and they're pounding on the door. So yeah, it's, I wouldn't trade it for the world though. I was blessed.
Absolutely. Being coachable, negotiation, some of the things you're learning at a young age. Also too, I remember a story you touched on. I can't remember what age you were, but you were a note taker. And how did that play a part in staying organized and also just being a note taker? Why would that be important for someone to think on that?
Well, I remember coming back from camp in fourth, fifth grade and taking notes. Like I would take notes from camp because I didn't want to forget. You know, I didn't want to, you had that week of camp and then you forgot, like a month later, you're trying to work on some skill and you forgot the drill that they used. So I would have my notebook with those drills and the teaching points of shooting so I could go back and refer to them because I didn't want to rely on my, memory, right? And so, people forget, paper remembers. And I was a note taker. I still am because your memory plays tricks on you and you need to have it written down. You need to document things. You need to memorialize things. And I'm big on notes. And when I teach and coach and, now as an executive coach, the big thing is the application of the lesson. Will you apply what you are learning? Or once this seminar is over, you feel great. Yeah, rah, rah, great talk. I'm motivated. And then the next day you go back to your old habits. Mm. You're not going to get better. My goal is to get better today. And so to get better, you got to create better habits. And to do that, it can be awkward. It could be hard. Change is, hard. And most people don't like change. Mm-hmm. So what are you doing different today than you did yesterday to move you closer to your dreams and goals? Because if you're not doing anything differently, then you just are hoping and wishing to achieve your dreams and goals.
What would you say, because you've worked with a lot of different people at a high level, what separates them, the people that actually go and apply what they learn versus people who go one in ear and out the other?
Yeah, I think just the discipline, mm-hmm. personal pride, discipline. When you were saying that, I'm thinking Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. I was blessed to play with Michael Jordan for 3 years. And, he was a guy that would show up early to practice and stay late and work on the things that the coaches were trying to help him with, pivoting, shooting. And when he got to the NBA, he was trying to get past the Detroit Pistons and they were physically beating him up. And so he decided he needed to get stronger. So he started lifting weights. He put a weight room in his house and he had a strength coach and he would have the breakfast of champions and they would lift weights at 6 a.m. He and Scottie Pippen and Ron Harper lift every day. And that was at 6 a.m. And who likes to do anything at 6 a.m? He knew he needed to do that to get better, to achieve his goals of beating the Pistons and being the best. So he made that decision and he had to be the one to get up and do it. So I think that you have to make a decision in terms of where do you want to go? What are the steps you need to get there? And then are you willing to execute on those steps? Because it's hard. I don't like getting up at 6 a.m. He was getting up at six to go work out. Kobe Bryant would work out like 4 a.m, like insane, right? So, you know, the old saying, no pain, no gain. And if you want to get something, what is your goal? And then what is the plan that you put in place to achieve those goals? And then do you execute on those goals?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then having people like yourself around you to hold you accountable is helpful, I think, as well.
Well, that's what I do as an executive coach now. I'm an executive coach and I hold people accountable. The meeting this morning, and I go over the meeting that I had with the person the last month, and they gave me two or three things that they were going to do. So when we meet, I'm going to lead with that. Did you do A, B, and C? Mm-hmm. And if they didn't, you know, you make them feel a little guilty. Like, how come?
Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, you know, you obviously don't really want to achieve the success that you said you want, because at the end of the day, it comes down to actions.
Absolutely. Well, going back into your career a little bit, you played for some great coaches growing up, and then you ultimately got to go to North Carolina. What did that decision-making process look like for you to get to North Carolina? And then talk a little bit about your experience playing for Coach Smith and on the teams that you're on.
Yeah. Well, I, again, go back to, I was blessed to have played for the coaches I did in grammar school and high school. And I, in the summers, the camps. So I was very good fundamentally. I could pass, handle, and shoot the ball. I knew how to pivot. I knew how to box out. I knew how to spacing on the floor. I knew how to move without the ball. I was really a student of the game. And I think in leadership, I talk about leadership a lot, and I talk about the first key to leadership is knowing yourself. And as a player, I knew myself. I knew what I was good at, and I knew what I wasn't good at. I wasn't a great athlete. I could not run and jump with the elite players. But I knew how to play. I could really pass. I could really move without the ball. I could see the floor. I knew how to – I could anticipate and I knew then that I needed to go to a place that would value that. And when you're making decisions, like any college kid, you know, high school kid looking at college, they have their stretch school and they have their safety school. So I was looking at North Carolina, Notre Dame, Virginia, Duke, but I was also looking at Holy Cross and Princeton. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, could I play? I was also looking at Davidson. Could I play at North Carolina? Now, I wasn't looking at, you know, schools like Louisville and Kentucky, and even though I was being recruited by some of them, but I didn't think I fit in as well as a place like North Carolina, where, you know, they valued your brain as much as they valued your legs, sure, you know, and your feet. And so I knew that at a place like maybe Maryland or Kentucky, or I could get lost. And so I wanted to win, and I wanted to be a part of a league. The ACC was the best basketball league at the time. North Carolina was always in the top 10. It was a good school academically. They had a history of recruiting players from the Northeast. And they also were going to lose players in my position. So I figured, okay, you know, that's the only thing I can control of who's in front of me. I can't control who's coming in after me. And ironically, the people that came in after me was a guy named Buzz Peterson, who was the player of the year in the state of North Carolina, and Michael Jordan. Yeah. And so, you know, and that's, you know, competition. So that raised my level of, okay, all right, yeah, it's on. If I want to play, I got to work. And so in the summers, you know, I was always working on my game, staying in shape. And yeah, I would jokingly say to, you know, I saw Michael, I saw Buzz, and I'm looking at Michael, I'm looking at Buzz, I'm looking at Michael, I'm looking at Buzz. And I say, Buzz, you ain't playing. I had to beat out Buzz to play because I wasn't going to beat out Michael. And you kind of knew that at a very young age.
Well, going so into that,
I think the big thing, Bailey, is self-awareness. And so in leadership, I talk about self-awareness and I talk about the six no's, K-N-O-W-S of leadership. And it starts with an acronym, STEVIT, I made up. Coaches love acronyms. And it's, self, team, environment, vision, industry, and then the truth. And I think we need to mine for the truth. I think that's a big thing people skip over. They don't like the truth because it's uncomfortable. They get defensive. And then sometimes we surround ourselves with yes men, yes women. And parents do this to their children. Oh, you're the best. You're the best. You're the best. You deserve to play, you know, blah, blah, blah. How about this? You know what? You're not the best.
Yeah.
How about this? We love you, but you're not the fastest on your team. You're not the tallest on the team. So, son, if you want to play, you got to be the hardest worker on the team. And if the coach puts you on the bench, the only thing that you can do is to show him in practice that you deserve to play. You know, I'm not calling the coach to complain about you not playing. I'm not going to find you another team to play on. This is a good life lesson for you. And that's not happening in our country today.
No, it's not. And typically whenever you work hard and if you're able to maximize your abilities, sometimes that means the outcome is you'll play. And sometimes it doesn't mean the outcome is you'll play. But I think you touched on being truthful and having self-awareness is key, not just in basketball, but in life for anybody on any team and in a family as well. That's important. So I think that transcends through all those things. But going back into being in North Carolina, you touched on those two guys coming in and talked about competition and working hard. And going into Michael, could you have seen, obviously he's Michael Jordan now, but in the moment, did you see those things translating into what he is today, or what were those things that he was doing differently?
Yeah, there's, you know, I get that question a lot. Did you think Michael would be, you know, the best player ever? And it's no, because it just would have been disrespectful to Larry Bird and Dr. J and Magic Johnson and Bill Russell and all those great players to say at 19 that he would have a chance to be that good. Because he wasn't even the best player on our team when he was a freshman. We had James Worthy.
Sure.
And so, but you saw the talent. And I remember the summer after his freshman year, he had hit the game-winning shot to beat Georgetown in 1982. And we're playing in pickup games. And he's going against a guy named Walter Davis, who is all pro and a great player at North Carolina and all pro with the Phoenix Suns. And he was really dominating the game. And I remember saying to myself, like, man, Michael, like, take it easy on him. Like, that's, you know, he's got his jersey in the rafters. And so, you know, I guess if I should have maybe projected at that time, but, you know, that he could be that good. But then, you know, when he got into the NBA and you saw him do it, especially in the Olympics, when he was on that Olympic team in 1984 and they were scrimmaging the NBA teams and he was, you know, kind of the best player on the floor, you're like, oh, my gosh. And then his rookie year, he, you know, scoring 45 points against the Spurs. And then you could see it. The thing that Michael has everything, right? He has the smarts. He has the talent. He has the desire. You know, those things are so key. The energy is something that is so understated. I was sitting with Donnie Walsh, who is a legendary NBA guy with the Pacers. And I used to visit with him when I was a scout, when I was scouting with the Pacers. I'd visit with him before games. And one day he said to me in his New York accent, you know, Maddie, the most important thing in basketball And I'm like hanging on every word. And I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be so magical. Nobody else is listening. I'm going to get the secret sauce. And I lean in and he says, the most important thing is energy. I'm like, oh my God, energy? And you think like all the great players have energy. Mm-hmm. All the great teams have energy because you need to fight through the emotional, you know, barriers. And the only way to do that is with energy, with force. And, you know, I thought about Michael Jordan. He had tremendous energy. You know, there's legendary stories about him going out to Atlantic City to 5 a.m. and then dropping 55 points against the Knicks the next day.
Yeah.
You know, in practice, they bring energy. Michael was always energetic in practice. And then I thought to, you know, guys that played with great energy and joy, from Magic Johnson to Dirk Nowitzki to Jason Kidd to LeBron James. I would see them, a lot of them practice when I was at SMU. They would come in to play the Dallas Mavericks and they would use our practice facility the day before for practice. And I'd see them in practice, Chris Paul, you know, like they were in the gym, they had a joy of the game, and that's contagious. So energy is such a gift that if you don't have it, you're not going to achieve greatness.
Mm. Yes, I love that. I think it's a great point. Having joy and having a passion for doing what you're doing, but also having the head smarts and then having the desire to be great at what you're doing and putting in the work, like you touched on before, is really key. And it's those fundamentals, going back to what you were talking about earlier, just practicing the fundamentals, but being really good at those things is really important. So kind of going into your story, you got to win a national championship, North Carolina, had a great career, and then you were wanting to play in the NBA. And how, talk a little bit about getting to the NBA or getting into professional basketball and then maybe getting out of that and then getting into coaching.
Yeah. So I got cut by the Cleveland Cavaliers. I was drafted in the sixth round where nobody makes it. They don't even have six rounds anymore, as you know. So I was really hurt because probably ever since I was 10, I loved the game. And, you know, I felt like it didn't love me back. It was almost like a girlfriend breaking up with you. So I was hurt. So I ran away from basketball, turned my back on it because I felt like it turned its back on me. Mm-hmm. And I went to work on Wall Street because I thought that was a cool substitute. Like, you know, I realized that I was probably more concerned with how people viewed me. You know, and that's so egotistical, so immature. Like I was concerned, like, oh, okay, you're not playing in the NBA. So at least I'm working on Wall Street, right? At least I have a chance to make a lot of money. Wall Street in the 80s was a very sexy place to work. The movie with Michael Douglas was very popular at the time.
Yeah.
And I forget the name of the movie, actually, but
You were in it, right? You know, he was Wall Street.
Yeah. That was the movie. Yeah, I guess it was with. And so, but quickly realized that I didn't love it. Mm. And after about 4 years, I tapped my boss on the shoulder one morning. I said, I'm leaving. And he said, what time are you coming back? And I said, no, I'm leaving. I'm out.
Yeah.
And I quit and moved to Charlotte. And then I got into the coaching part moved to Charlotte, thought I was going to get in the real estate business, and started coaching an AAU team and fell in love with coaching. And I was doing the radio at Davidson. They made a coaching change and hired Bob McKillop, who, as I said earlier, was my high school coach. Mm-hmm. And he asked me to join staff. And I loved that. I loved the recruiting. I loved the coaching. I love the camaraderie, and it was something I felt like I was good at. And so yeah, then I didn't mind, like, you know, the hours. I didn't mind getting up at 6 a.m. I didn't mind working to midnight watching film. I didn't mind getting in the car, driving 7 hours to go see a kid play. I like that. And so that led me to Kansas for 7 years, where I worked for Roy Williams. And then, you know, I was looking at head coaching jobs. I turned down a couple. And then I'm thinking, after 7 years, like, maybe I'm staying too long. Maybe I won't get a head coaching job. And then I became the head coach at Notre Dame, which was just a tremendous fit for me, being an Irish Catholic kid from New York. And I thought I'd be there forever, until I wasn't. And North Carolina came knocking after Roy Williams turned it down. And, you know, thought I'd be at North Carolina forever. And sure. And I wasn't. So we make plans and God laughs, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a great point. One, and kind of going into that, you got to beat North Carolina. And then you've got this book that you wrote called Rebound. And so you had, you know, great first season. You talked about some turmoil there in your third season. And then you had to rebound from that. And I know that was a challenging time, but what are some lessons you learned as you look back on that experience? Because I know that really shaped your leadership journey, is what you talked about.
Yes. Yes. I think the first thing I learned, Bailey, is emotional intelligence, self-awareness. I was sitting in a class at Wharton. You know, I took executive classes. So, you know, it's not like you have to apply to get in. You just have to have the money to get in. Okay. And so I got to this class, and this lady's teaching this class on emotional intelligence. And I never heard of emotional intelligence before. This is 2003. And as she's talking and reading, we're studying out of this book, Primal Leadership, The Art of Emotional Intelligence. I was like, oh my gosh, like, I have no idea. I had no idea about emotional intelligence. And afterwards, after the class, I went up to her and talked to her. Name's Fran Johnston. And she ended up offering to coach me. So I worked with Fran for several months. I would fly to Philadelphia in the morning and meet with her and fly home that night. And so emotional intelligence, the self-awareness, as I touched on earlier, is something that I learned. And to even go farther with that, I'm big on assessments, you know, DISC assessments, Myers-Briggs. And I took an assessment with a lady at UVA. And one thing about me, like, if you tell me I need to work on something, I'll go overboard and do it, like, you know, which is a blessing and a curse. So I took all kinds of assessments, and I worked with this other executive coach at UVA. I took a class there, and it was the Myers-Briggs. And after she got the results, she was telling me that I'm an ENTJ. And I laugh, I jokingly say, well, I've been called a lot of four letter words, but never an ENTJ. And she said only 2% of the population are ENTJs. And I'm thinking that North Carolina just fired an elite coach. Like, if I'm in the top 2% of the world, like, what the heck?
Yeah.
And as I was thinking this, I know she was thinking, oh, he doesn't get it at all. Like, the point is 98% of the people don't think like I think. And when she told me that, it was an aha moment for me, because I realized that I try to get people to think like me. And I thought I was right the way I thought. And most people don't. And so, you know, you could move people, but you got to do it in a way that inspires people to follow. You know, a friend of mine said, there's a lot of tools in the toolbox. And like, I was using the hammer. Okay. And I should have used the pliers. I should have used the screwdriver. And you know, I was using the hammer And that doesn't end well. It might work short term, but it doesn't work long term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's like, I think John Wooden might have this quote. It's like, what we know after it all that counts, you know? So, but
yeah. I would have liked to know. So that's why I wrote the book. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm an executive coach, because I want to help people avoid the landmines I stepped on.
Mm.
Like as they go into this minefield, they're trying to get across to the other side. It's like a football field with landmines on it. And you're starting at the 0 yard line. Okay. All right, Bailey, at the 10 yard line, 5 yards from the sideline, there's a landmine there. It's called self-awareness. Be careful.
Yeah.
Okay. Then you're going to get to the 15 yard line, center field. All right. There's one there that's called team. You got to really know the people on your team and how to work with them. Okay. And then there's another one called environment. You're stepping into this environment. Do they want change or do they not want change? So when I took over at Notre Dame, they wanted change and I brought it gladly and it was embraced. Mm-hmm. At North Carolina, they needed the same similar change, but they didn't want it because they had 37 years of massive success. They didn't think they needed it. So any change was a shock to their system, and they took as me being disrespectful to the traditions there. Mm. I didn't understand the environment, which is foolish because I played there, but I didn't really study it. And I didn't take the time to go slow. You know, then the vision, okay, do you create your vision? Because if you don't know where you're going to go, how are people going to follow you? And then do you know your industry? Like, are you an expert, a subject matter expert in your industry? Now, you know, GE, Jack Welch, you know, didn't have to know how to make a widget, but he was an expert at leading organizations. Mm-hmm. And then the truth, do you mine for the truth? Because if you don't manage the truth will manage you right out the door.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it kind of goes back into your Stevet and the core values that you have, but also learning and having that emotional awareness, like you talked about, to understand the situation and the people around you and understanding how to use all the tools in your toolbox. But there's a point that you made earlier to get better, not bitter. And how did you work on that after you got let go from North Carolina? Because you touched on the book. I mean, that's a challenging thing to go through. And I think a lot of people don't realize as coaches, you know, your people too. So you have to go through these things and you're in the national spotlight too. And North Carolina is a big job and you've had a lot of success. What was it like to get better, not bitter, especially when you had all those guys coming in and they won the national championship just a few years later?
No, I mean, it was very hard, you know, to lose your job. You know, it's the Carolina family. You're part of the family. You're a starter on a national championship team. You're asked to come back. You come back, you give up a good job. And then 3 years later, you're asked to resign. And so, and then, you know, a person you work for and played for, and Roy Williams, takes your job. Mm-hmm. And people say, what was that like? I said, well, let me ask you, how would you feel if your best friend married your ex-wife? That'd be weird, right?
Yeah,
he has the right to do that, but it's weird.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's kind of what happened. And so, you know, it's weird. And it was national. And I was, you know, a lot of former players didn't like me, didn't like some of the things that I supposedly did. And some of them still don't, you know, like me because I didn't keep a former player on staff, or there was rumors that I was taking down pictures of national championship teams. I was just renovating the locker room and they had to take the pictures off the wall so they wouldn't fall off the wall and break. I put a picture of Michael Jordan hitting a game-winning shot in the lobby of our office. There was no picture of Michael Jordan in the lobby. And so there was two pictures of him hitting the game-winning shot against Georgetown in 1982, one with our bench in the background, the other one with me in the background. I'm at the foul line with my hands up next to Patrick Ewing.
That's why you put it up, right?
It's why I put up that picture, because I wanted to have recruits, when my assistants brought recruits in, say, see, Matt played with Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
You know, so to make that, because everything sells, right? You're selling.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so there was rumors going around that I was taking down pictures of championship teams and putting up pictures of myself.
Yeah.
You know, and so how do you manage that as a leader? And I think the mistake I made was managing change is an art form, and I didn't study the environment. I didn't take the time to study. I didn't have the time, though. I took the job July 11th, and you, with your basketball background, you know July 11th is the busiest time of year for a college coach because it's recruiting season. And I had to go out on the road recruit. I felt that we were behind in recruiting. But looking back, I probably should have gone slower with that and sat and got to spend time with the secretaries. You say, oh, the secretaries. Yeah, North Carolina had 4.5 secretaries. I had 4 secretaries that had been there an average probably of 20, 25 years each. And I had a part-time secretary, office assistant. What other basketball office do you know that has that many secretaries?
Yeah.
Right?
It's a lot.
I mean, that's a major corporation. And then on top of that, Dean Smith and Bill Guthridge, who were retired, had offices in the building. So when there was some dissension, people could go to them. And so there was no like firewall, like where it just stopped. Like, no, the buck stops here. You don't like it, you could leave, or you got to deal with it. So that fire spread like wildfire and ultimately consumed me.
Absolutely. And I think you bring up a good point, because you got to learn all these things when you look back and have perspective on it, but you had a willingness to learn from that and be coachable, like you talked about before. And I think that's really important, because there's so many things in life where we can get bitter about things not going our way, or get frustrated with other people. But if you have the perspective and the mindset to get better and not get bitter, that can change a lot of things. Doesn't mean it's going to change the situation, but you can learn from it. And as you step into the next thing, it's going to enable you to have a better mindset and perspective.
Well, thank you. So I think this is where we need people. Your life's impacted by 3 things: the people you meet, the books you read, and the trauma in your life. So the people I met, you know, we talked about that. Bob McKillop, my high school coach. He becomes the head coach at Davidson. He hires me. Roy Williams, I played for him as an assistant coach. He becomes the head coach at Kansas. He hires me. Played with Michael Jordan, played for Dean Smith. They influenced my life in such a positive way. And so those are the people I met. The books I read. In sixth grade, I read a book by Bill Bradley called Life on the Run. And he had a quote in there that went something like, you know, if somebody else is working harder on their game, and when you meet that person will have the advantage. That's when I quit playing baseball and focused solely on basketball. So books you read impact your life. And then the trauma of me losing my job impacted my life and put me on a leadership journey. And so I studied leadership and became passionate about it and said, oh, okay. So I'm a better leader now as a result. And, you know, that trauma I'm going to put to good use. And you look at history and you see people who faced setbacks and adversity and they went through it. You don't hit like adversity. You don't hit an adversity wall. It's like a car wash. You go through adversity and you come out better on the other end for it. It's just hard as hell to recognize that as you're going through it. And I love collecting quotes. And one of my favorite quotes is from Nelson Mandela. He says, I never lose. I either win or I learn. And so that kind of mindset removes a lot of fear and realizes that, okay, what's the worst thing that can happen? I could lose my job, but I'll be better off for it in the big picture, because I'll be better as a leader. I'll be better as a owner. I'll be better for my next opportunity.
Yes.
And that's the kind of mindset I think that the great people have. You know, I'm getting ready to do a talk next week at a conference, and you look at people like Nelson Mandela, you look at people like Oprah Winfrey. She got fired from her first TV job. Michael Jordan got cut from a basketball team in high school. Steve Jobs got forced to resign at Apple. Like, imagine if those people just said, oh, okay, I'm not good. Other people, Walt Disney got fired from the Kansas City Star, saying he had no imagination. Imagine if he listened. We wouldn't have Mickey freaking Mouse.
That's right. Yeah, and I think those are great points, to be able to have the diligence to push through those things and and have the perspective and mindset to come out better. I think it's great. Well, there's one thing I really want to touch on too, because I've not heard this super often, but having a personal board of directors, you touched on that. How important is that, and how do you go around and find people to come on your personal board and help you accountable and help you move forward?
Yeah. So, as coaches, we steal ideas, right? We steal plays, we steal drills, and we do that in leadership too. We should. So personal board of directors, that term I stole from Bob Bodine, who's in Dallas, a famous author and executive recruiter. And it made sense for me, because you know, big companies have a board of directors, right, that they go to for advice. So we should have a board of directors, and basically it's mentors, right? Who are your mentors? And you know, you can have more than just one. You know, you should probably have a financial mentor. You probably should have a health mentor. You should probably have a career mentor. You know, a marriage counselor mentor. You know, like who is on your team? So when you're going to make a big decision, you know, financial investment, you're going to make a career pivot, who do you talk to that's going to give you honest feedback? And that ultimately, that's what I do as an executive coach. It is peer advisory. So I'm a Vistage chair. It's one of the oldest executive coaching organizations in the country. And we bring together 15 to 20 business owners, CEOs, founders, presidents, that come together in a room and act as a personal board of directors that have one goal, and it's to help each other become better. And it's a safe environment. There's no judgment. There's nobody saying, oh my gosh, what an idiot. Bailey just, you know, was putting down $1 million on this multifamily unit. Everyone knows that neighborhood's not going anywhere. Yeah. Like, what an idiot. As opposed to, hey, Bailey, before you make this decision, I've done this in the past. I screwed up and I did these three things before I looked at a property. You know, maybe that's something you should consider. Mm. Right. And you're like, whoa, okay. And then all of a sudden you do those things, and now it's either validates why you're making this decision to buy it, or now you say, oh, that's not a good deal. I didn't realize that I should have studied the foundation, or that there's oil tanks underneath the property, or whatever it might be.
Some landmines.
you didn't think about. So that's the personal board of directors.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, real quickly, I want to get you out of here on time. There's two questions I'd love to ask you. First and foremost, you know, what does it mean in your opinion to be a good husband and father?
Oh gosh. You know, like, it's like Christianity. You know, people ask about Christianity, I consider myself a Christian, and I'm like, in basketball, we always rate players like on a 5-star scale. And I feel like I'm a 3-star Christian. And people say, you're either a Christian or you're not. There's no degrees of Christianity. because we're all flawed, right? So I feel like that when you say as a husband or a father, like maybe I'm a three-star father, a three-star husband, because, you know, there's so many things that I wish I was better at, right? And, you know, you know, I wish I was more patient. I wish I was a better listener. Like in my job as an executive coach, I have to be a good listener. And then I come home and then like my listening sponge is full, you know, there's no more, I've got to wring out the sponge so I can listen better. So, you know, it's a fatherhood, being a husband, it's a skill, like leadership. You have to practice it, like be intentional. And I'm not great at it, you know? I mean, and there's times like, okay, I don't feel like doing yard work. Like, I don't like you doing yard work. I work during the week. I don't like to do yard work.
Yeah.
But I know that my wife, you know, there's a good book called The Five Love Languages, and acts of service is one of her, you know, love languages. So if I do yard work, she like, wow, like that's big for her. And so, you know, I should do yard work. I should, you know, take out the trash. I should do. So I have to be cognizant and intentional about those things. And, you know, and with my kids, you know, you always look back and you say, I wish I should have done this better. I should have done that better. You know, because we're all like comparing. Comparison games are work of the devil. And you see somebody else who maybe did this for their children and I didn't do it for our children. So you fear that, you deal with the guilt of that. You know, and like we moved a lot. You know, I moved my son going into ninth grade, my daughter going to eighth grade from Dallas to North Carolina. Well, should I have? You know, maybe I shouldn't have. You know, and so you can only do the best with the information you have at the time.
Absolutely.
And I think at the end of the day, hopefully what I try to do is model the behavior I want my kids to have. And that's like dealing with adversity. Like, okay, I had to pivot several times in my career to find a way to provide for my family. You know, get out of bed, go to work, make an honest living, you know, treat people with respect, pray, go to church. And now my kids are 25 and 23, so you really can't tell them. You just kind of have to model it.
Absolutely.
So I think I skirted the answer.
No, that was great.
I'm probably a three-star dad and a three-star husband striving to be a four-star.
Aren't we all? So, well, real quickly, the final question I have for you, this podcast is called Building Excellence. What does building excellence mean to you?
Yeah, I think it's my motto. I have two key things I say all the time: learn and grow. We got to live curiously, continue to be curious and to learn and grow. And that kind of morphs into like, get better today. You know, if you can get better every day, you get reach fulfillment, self-fulfillment. And for each people, different people is different. We all have different capacity, right? So, you know, you want to live your best life, you want to reach fulfillment, and to do that, you need to surround yourself with good people and good books, good podcasts, like your podcast.
There you go. We'll send you that $20 in the mail. So for that plug,
I thought it was 25, Bailey. I thought that was what the agreement was.
Well, speaking of good books, here we've got another one too. So you wrote a book called Rebound, and thank you so much for coming on the show and kind of sharing your story and some of the lessons that you've learned. But also in your book, you do share a lot of that and you elaborated on it even more. And you also have coaching and a website. So what's the best way to kind of, you know, find out more about the book, if someone wanted to buy it, and then also look and follow you on social media?
Yeah, no, thank you. I think the best thing to do is just go to my website, DohertyCoaching.com. That's DohertyCoaching, DohertyCoaching.com. And, you know, you could find, you could buy my book through that. You can find out about my coaching, and I give keynote talks. I enjoy doing that. That's like, you know, game day for me. So everything that you'd like to learn about in terms of books, speaking, coaching is on that website, DohertyCoaching.com.
Awesome. Well, Coach, thank you so much for coming on. I think your perspective on, you know, being able to help people navigate and not hit landmines, because you've been able to learn from your past experiences. And also, it's, you know, it's like the point where, you know, someone who plants a tree and is planting it for the next generation so their shade to be there, you're absolutely doing that. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Bailey. It means a lot. I appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Building Excellence Podcast. If you found value today, we would really appreciate it if you shared the show and left a rating and review. Also, be sure to follow us on all podcasts and social platforms, as well as YouTube, where you can watch full video episodes. To learn more about the podcast or any coaching or speaking, check out BaileyMiles.com. Thanks again, and now go work to build excellence in your life, leadership, and legacy.